KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The intention seems likely to be to suppress the vote rather than to try to make our elections filled with greater integrity.
A new executive order requires proof of citizenship to register to vote.
Today is Wednesday, March 26th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. New sectarian violence under Syria's transitional government.
It's raising concerns about what the new Syria will be like.
I'm here at the river, the border between Lebanon and Syria. In front of me now, I see a family getting ready to cross.
Also, so-called marginal oil wells produce just a small fraction of America's oil.
But they could be a big deal to the environment.
These piddly little wells that are just drip-drabbing out a little bit of profit while polluting on the other end, they're not worth it.
Those stories, first the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Atlantic has now released the full text of a chat over an encrypted app involving senior Trump administration national security officials, which somehow included journalist Jeffrey Goldberg. NPR's Greg Myrie says it appears the chat was well underway even before military men and women were in the air.
2 hours before the operation began on March 15th, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth wrote, quote, "We are a go for mission launch." And then he kept providing updates, saying F-18 warplanes and Reaper drones had taken off to carry out attacks. And keep in mind, the Houthis have shot down U.S. drones, so there are some real risks here. And Hegseth gave these real-time updates for several hours. He knew he was on Signal and not a secure government network, but he, of course, was unaware Goldberg had been inadvertently included in this group.
The attacks against the Houthi rebels in Yemen, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Representative Jim Himes of Connecticut, says the discussion of war plans should have been classified at the highest level. Vice President J.D. Vance is embarking on a trip to Greenland this week. He'll visit the only U.S. military base there. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports defense experts say it's critical to American national security.
Bidufeek Space Base is a Space Force installation on the northwestern coast of Greenland. Its location between the northern U.S. and Russia is critical to the U.S. military, says Troy Buffard, a professor of Arctic security at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
The center sector there with that base is absolutely paramount.
The military conducts missile warning, missile defense, and space surveillance missions there. Construction on the base began in secret in 1951 in a joint effort between the U.S. and Denmark, which partially controls Greenland. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio is visiting Jamaica this week, talking about energy security, trade, and how to make U.S. aid more effective. He's defending the Trump administration's decision to dismantle the U.S. Agency for International Development. Here's NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
At the embassy in Jamaica, USAID employees are still on administrative leave as the Trump administration battles lawsuits back in Washington. But Secretary Rubio says the U.S. is not getting out of the aid business.
We are going to be providing foreign aid. The difference is we want to provide foreign aid in a way that is strategically aligned with our foreign policy priorities and the priorities of our host countries and our nation states that we're partners with.
But he's asking countries in this region not to accept doctors from Cuba, which he says are forced to labor. Jamaica's prime minister says Cuban doctors are incredibly helpful, and his country is careful not to exploit them. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Jamaica.
On Wall Street, stocks lost ground today. The Dow dropped 132 points. The Nasdaq fell 372 points. You're listening to NPR. After hearing arguments this morning, it's looking like the Supreme Court may be inclined to preserve the roughly $8 billion the government spends annually to subsidize internet and phone services in schools, libraries, and rural areas. Justices heard nearly 3 hours of arguments as they reviewed a ruling that struck down as unconstitutional the Universal Service Fund. That tax has been tacked on to consumer phone bills for nearly 30 years. Both liberal and conservative justices expressed concerns about eliminating that funding. A Russian court has convicted 12 Ukrainians captured in the siege of the city of Mariupol on terrorism charges and sentenced them to lengthy prison terms. The trial was closely watched in both Russia and Ukraine. More from NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow.
Russian authorities say the Ukrainians were members of the Azov Brigade, a military unit captured following a weeks-long stand against Russian troops from inside a Mariupol steel mill in the spring of 2022. In Ukraine, the Azov fighters are lionized as heroes. In Russia, they're demonized as neo-fascists and a reason the Kremlin launched its full-scale invasion. The verdict was issued in the southern city of Rostov-on-Don, with the Ukrainians receiving between 13 and 23-year sentences. Several others were convicted in absentia, having been released in earlier prisoner swaps. Ukraine has compared the trial to a war crime, with several of the Ukrainians alleging torture by prison guards in their statements to the court. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Crude oil futures prices moved higher today. That's amid new government data showing crude and fuel inventories fell last week. Oil up 65 cents a barrel to settle at $69.65 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump signed an executive order yesterday that aims to make sweeping changes to elections and voter registration, including a proof of citizenship requirement. Legal experts are calling it an overreach of presidential authority and warn that the provisions could block tens of millions of eligible Americans from voting. Joining us now with more is NPR's Jude Joffe Block. Hi, Jude.
Hello.
Hello. Okay, so what exactly is in this executive order?
Right. Well, there's a lot in here. And so it lays out a number of new requirements and says if states don't comply, they will not get federal funding. So one big change is this new proof of citizenship requirement to register to vote in federal elections. So you'd need to show a copy of a citizenship document, like a passport, to a local or state official in order to register to vote, or whenever you update your registration, like if you move. Another change, the executive order aims to stop states from counting mailed ballots that are postmarked by election day but arrive after. This is something that a lot of states allow.
Wait, legally, can the president make all of these changes simply by executive order?
Well, that's really the key question. So Trump is trying to assert that he, as president, has authority over elections, and that's not been the case. We have a decentralized system where states make a lot of their own election rules. But this order seeks to expand the president's power and test how far it can go. We've already heard from voting rights advocates that lawsuits are going to challenge this. And normally, an overhaul like this would be something for Congress to take on. And in fact, Republicans have been backing a bill called the SAVE Act that includes a lot of the same provisions as this order. That bill likely faces an uphill battle in the Senate. So instead, some critics are saying Trump is forcing through that legislation by executive fiat.
Well, what has President Trump said about why he's pushing these changes?
Well, he says it's necessary for election integrity. Here he is yesterday when he signed the order.
We got to straighten out our election. This country is so sick because of the election, the fake elections and the bad elections.
You know, of course, Trump touts the results of the last election, which he won, but it's long been part of his brand to make false claims about voter fraud, most notably when he denied the results of the 2020 election. And in the lead up to this past election, he and his allies made baseless claims about the threat of non-citizens voting in large numbers, which we know from audits and studies that such cases are really rare, yet that's what they're targeting here.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm curious, how are voting experts reacting to this order?
Well, I spoke with UCLA law professor Rick Hassan, and he brought up how very rare these cases of non-citizen voting are, but that a proof of citizenship requirement would have a big impact and could disenfranchise millions of voters.
So you'd be using a very strict rule to prevent a very small amount of fraud. The intention seems likely to be to suppress the vote rather than to try to make our elections filled with greater integrity.
And, you know, people are already asked on voter registration forms to attest under penalty of perjury if they're citizens and eligible to vote, and they can face prison or deportation if they try to vote illegally.
Okay. Say more about how Rick Hassan told you if this order stands, millions of voters could be disenfranchised. Like, how would that happen exactly?
Well, past studies have found that almost 1 in 10 Americans doesn't have a proof of citizenship document or doesn't have easy access to one. And this order is also a bit vague about which documents would even be accepted as proof. It doesn't explicitly name birth certificates. It does name passports, but only about half of Americans have those. They cost money and take a while to get. This rule would likely upend voter registration drives and other ways that Americans are used to signing up to vote. So this would really be a sea change.
That is NPR's Jude Joffe Block. Thank you, Jude.
Thank you.
Spring is when gardeners start thinking about seedlings, those little baby plants all ready to get plunked into the ground. And as NPR's Netta Ulaby tells us, a new technique for growing them has captured the attention of serious gardeners.
It's called soil blocking.
These are all the soil blocks.
At a community garden center called Growing Hope in Ypsilanti, Michigan, Christopher Hellett is teaching a class on soil blocking, starting with the soil composition itself.
Peat moss, lime, perlite, blood meal.
Then, he tells six aspiring soil blockers, you mix it all together.
Take your fingers and go boom, 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 boom.
Soil blocking is exactly what it sounds like. You use a special metal tool to squish the dirt into self-contained blocks. Imagine a galvanized metal container about the size of a tissue box with a lever to push out the packed soil blocks, a little like an old-fashioned ice cube tray.
They're going to be squeaky.
Each dirt block becomes a home for seeds. Once they sprout, and after it's safe from frost, you can stick the blocks directly in the ground. Grace Wartonen, an intern here, shows off orderly rows of soil-blocked seedlings in trays.
Onions, collards, chard, chives.
Wartonen puts together 50 trays of soil blocks every day.
This is my whole job, to do soil blocking.
The tools come in different sizes, she says. Small ones for herbs, big ones for squash. They cost less than $20 and should last for 20 years. Soil blocking appeals to one person in this class, Donna Kolajewski, because it's environmentally friendly.
You don't have to use as much plastic, less wasteful.
Than disposable plastic containers of seedlings at big box stores. Even peat and peat pots, she points out, are not a sustainable resource. Kolajewski says she's happy to be learning a new technique. She's a retiree who has gardened her whole life.
And I'm getting seedier by the day.
Another member of the class is a new gardener. Osprey Elliott lives in an apartment.
We'll see how it goes. I'm probably going to do the seed blocks. Like, I have like a shelf set up in my room.
With a light, like a mini greenhouse, she says. Yeah. Enough to start a few seedlings she hopes to give to friends. Meanwhile, another member of the class wants to improve her gardening game because she says food safety and supply is beginning to feel unreliable.
You know, I'm not trusting food anymore that I'm getting, so I just want to grow my own.
Amarita Oliver says she's leaning into self-sufficiency.
I want to learn how to can and do all kinds of stuff because we live in a crazy world. I need to grow my own food, so that's where my head is.
Her hands are in the soil, busy blocking. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
There was euphoria in December when Syria's civil war appeared to end with the ouster of President Bashar al-Assad. But fresh sectarian violence under a new transitional government has many questioning what the new Syria will really be like. From neighboring Lebanon, NPR's Jawad Rizkhalas spoke with survivors. Many of them did not want to give full names because they fear for their lives. And a warning, one of their accounts includes a description of extreme violence against children.
Syria's new government hasn't allowed journalists to reach coastal areas, but I managed to reach a resident there by phone. This man, who goes by Abu Layla, described seeing hundreds of men with machine guns shooting their way down his street. He and his wife grabbed their toddler and fled into the woods. From there, they watched an elderly neighbor get gunned down in the street. He says he wishes he could escape, but feels trapped. Other Syrians have fled across the border into Lebanon.
I'm here at the river, the border between Lebanon and Syria. In front of me now, I see a family taking off their shoes and getting ready to cross.
These people are Alawites, from the same offshoot sect of Shia Islam as the deposed President Bashar al-Assad. Some Sunnis see them as propping up the old regime. Earlier this month, after some old regime loyalists attacked the new Syrian army in what looked like a challenge to the new regime, many mosques in different parts of Syria broadcast a call to battle. In the ensuing crackdown on the coast, where many Alawites live, civilians also came under attack, in what human rights groups say were massacres of anywhere from 600 to 1600 people, with thousands still missing.
A 10-day old baby. They slaughtered him, stomped on him in front of my eyes.
This woman named Sana says she watched this happen to her neighbor's child. After that, she fled her own house, which the gunmen set on fire. She describes walking 45 miles, being shot at, and then finally being escorted to safety by the Lebanese army. They met Sana in a shelter set up at a mosque near the river, where people have been crossing into Lebanon by the hundreds each day. A boy in a sling, his arm had been shot. Charities hand out food and drag in mattresses for people to rest. Most of the refugees here say their attackers wore government uniforms. Zainab Ahmed says some of her attackers were wearing the signature black uniforms of state security. Others, she says, wore the colors of militias that are nominally under state control. She saw them from her balcony arguing over whether or not to kill a man they had already beaten in the street. Within days, the Syrian government announced an investigation commission and later released images showing the arrests of suspects who'd published video of their crimes on social media. And Syria's new president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, who has promised an inclusive Syria, made a televised speech promising accountability. Anyone who assaults unarmed civilians will face severe consequences, he said. Some of the refugees here are wary of his past, though, and his previous ties to Al-Qaeda, which sees Alawites as heretics. 10 years ago, Sharaa himself told Al Jazeera, that he considers Alawites deviants from Islam and blames all of them for Assad's crimes. So it's unclear whether Syria's new leader has been really willing to halt these killings or whether he's even able to control the more extremist members of his forces that are still operating under the old rhetoric. Until then, no one here feels safe going home. Jawad Rizqallah, NPR News, on the Lebanon-Syria border.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The vast majority of U.S. oil wells produce very little oil. That might sound like a paradox, but it's just what happens when geology, economics, and policy collide. NPR's Camila Domonoske reports on how a little bit of oil can be a very big deal, both for producers making money and environmentalists concerned about greenhouse gases.
There are parts of the world where you can still stick a drill into the earth and the oil just comes gushing out. Oklahoma is not one of them. Not anymore.
The easy oil is gone.
Scott Rabinowitz has been pulling oil out of the ground for 25 years. Last year, he walked me through his Bird Creek oil field, packed with pump jacks, like oversized hammers swinging back and forth above the wells. There's still oil underground, but after a century of production, what's left is hard to get out. Imagine the oil reservoir is a big cup of soda, packed with ice. Stick in a straw, and the first sip is easy, but the emptier it gets, the less you get with each sip. Or Rabinowitz's metaphor.
A reservoir is like a balloon. You pull out the oil, there's less energy to drive the oil, gas, and water to the wellbore.
Old wells and depleted reservoirs drip rather than gush, not just in Oklahoma. Across the country, 77% of oil wells combined make just 6% of the country's oil. They're called marginal wells, typically first drilled by big companies and then sold off once they slow down. But even a marginal bit of oil can still be worth a chunk of money. And government policy has long encouraged keeping these old wells open, so none of that oil goes to waste. There are special tax breaks, and the industry fights hard to keep them. Rabinowitz is extending the lifespan of his old wells, actively working to squeeze more oil out. He walked me over to one of his wells, first drilled in the 1920s by Texaco, and pumping today.
So how much oil does this well make?
This well makes about 3 barrels a day.
3 barrels a day is pretty close to nothing. New wells average over 1,000 per day, but everything is relative. This well still makes thousands of dollars a month, and Rabinowitz has hundreds of wells. Marginal wells are a growing concern for environmentalists. While these wells make 6% of U.S. oil, studies suggest they're responsible for more like half of the oil industry's methane pollution. Methane, or natural gas, is often found with oil, and it's a very potent greenhouse gas when it leaks into the atmosphere. Adam Peltz is with the Environmental Defense Fund.
Marginal wells are not a marginal issue. There's 800,000 of them. Most wells are marginal wells. Every well eventually becomes a marginal well.
Peltz argues government policy should put more focus on keeping marginal wells from polluting.
We need to figure out a way to make sure that these wells don't emit, they get plugged when they're done, and the people who have been relying on them economically still have a way to survive economically. So it's a big challenge, but it's time for us to take it on.
Kara Joy McKee with the Sierra Club of Oklahoma says this issue is personal to Oklahomans.
Almost everyone in Oklahoma has someone in their family working in oil and gas or knows someone, loves someone working in oil and gas.
But, she argues,
these piddly little wells that are just drip-drabbing out a little bit of profit while polluting on the other end, they're not worth it. The health costs to our society and the future costs to our world are really way too high to pay.
Rabinowitz doesn't deny climate science. He recognizes making oil and gas comes at an environmental cost, a cost which isn't factored into the finances of these aging wells. But when he looks at marginal wells, he sees opportunity. These wells don't have a lot of oil left in them, but they could still have a lot of life.
How long will it be able to make 3 barrels a day?
This well will be here as long as we manage the reservoir. This well should be here for another 30 or 40 years.
Making a little bit of oil for a long, long time. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Every week, a guest draws a card from the wild card deck and answers a big question about their life. Uzo Aduba landed her breakthrough role the day she quit acting. She had decided to go to law school when she found out that she got the part of Suzanne Crazy Eyes Warren on the hit show Orange is the New Black. Now, over a decade later, Uzo Aduba is taking on the lead role in the latest Shonda Rhimes production, The Residence, on Netflix. Cordelia Cupp is a detective who has been called in to solve a murder in the White House.
She's the world's greatest detective. She's smart. She's persistent. She's insistent. She's an incredible listener. She doesn't miss a beat.
Aduba shares her character's confidence, something that she says her parents instilled in her. She talked with Wildcard host Rachel Martin about her relationship with her mom.
What's an experience from childhood that made you realize your parents were only human?
You know, my parents, immigrants, came here working hard, five kids, very humble beginnings financially. Seven of us, and they lived in a three-bedroom house for majority of my life, you know. And when I was really little, I think in the second grade, to help supplement the household income, my mom worked at McDonald's. And she was a social worker by trade, mm-hmm. but she picked up a shift as a manager at a McDonald's. And I thought it was so cool, because we got to go to McDonald's.
Right, you got free stuff, probably.
We'd never gone. I thought it was so cool. And I was like, this is awesome. You know, we get all the chicken nuggets we could ever ask for. It's amazing, you know? And then cut to when I was in high school, we needed some supplemental income again. And she was working at a Sears in the clothing section. Mm-hmm. And my mom, who has a double master's, working at Sears, and I felt so self-conscious of it as a kid, and I'm not proud of this at all. I remember I was just such a brat to her one day. Mm-hmm. I came in there because it was at the mall, and I was afraid somebody was going to see her because I thought she was above it, whatever that even means.
Yep.
And she was just tolerant, is the best I can say, of my poor behavior.
Yeah.
And I just remember realizing as a grown person, I guess, that whatever version in my mind of her that I thought she was, as like this, you know, fierce academic who, you know, had a certain profession, at the end of the day, she was just a mom who was doing whatever she needed to do to get by.
Yeah.
And I wound up having to call her, you know, and she...
How'd she respond?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. She was gracious, the woman that she always was. She's like, oh, Uzo, don't you worry about that. You know, just nothing to forgive. There was nothing to forgive.
You can see Uzo Aduba in the next Netflix series, The Residence. And you can hear more of that conversation on the Wildcard podcast.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com.
This is NPR News.
There's a shortage of primary care doctors in the U.S., and wait times for appointments are long. In response, some doctors are converting their practices to a membership model. They charge membership fees to patients in exchange for reliable care.
But that means fewer people have access. So each time any physician makes that switch, it exacerbates the shortage.
That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Online platforms have made it easier than ever to go from anonymity to online fame and fortune.
But that kind of viral success can also come at a cost.
I had three cops to my right, I had three to my left, and one of them yelled, "I found Peanut. I found the squirrel."
First This News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The White House and President Trump continue to downplay the messages sent through a public online group chat in which the defense secretary provided highly specific details of imminent U.S. airstrikes in Yemen. President Trump and other members of his cabinet claimed the group chat that included the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine didn't include classified information. Former Defense Department official in Trump's first term, Mick Mulroy, says the current administration is just making excuses.
There would be an immediate investigation launched. They'd be removed from any access to classified information. And if this is what they in fact did, they'd likely get court-martialed. So, and I think everybody in the military knows that is the case. And unfortunately, instead of owning up to it and taking responsibility, it seems to be that they're making excuses for every reason why they could be able to do this.
The Trump administration is beginning to step away from voting rights lawsuits first brought during the Biden administration. NPR's Hansi Luong reports voting rights advocates fear this could weaken legal protections against racial discrimination in elections.
The Justice Department dropped its lawsuit over Texas redistricting maps and its case against the Georgia county's election system, both that claimed the collective power of voters of color was being diluted in violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Former DOJ official Gilda Daniels says she's concerned some Republican state officials are trying to block people from bringing these kinds of lawsuits.
If you actually make it harder to demonstrate that a Section 2 violation exists, and at an administration that is reluctant and or unwilling to bring Section 2 cases, it could lead to dormancy that I don't think we want to see as a democracy.
Georgia officials have asked the DOJ to drop its case against the state's election laws. Hansi Luong, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR. In Maryland, state officials gathered today in Baltimore to remember the six lives lost in the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge 1 year ago after a massive container ship struck the bridge.
We came to call Alejandro's name, Carlos's name, Jose's name.
At the water's edge, a somber crowd gathered. Among them were the families of the six construction workers who were on the bridge at the time of its collapse. Maryland Governor Wes Moore was one of the many officials in attendance.
The six victims of the Key Bridge collapse, they should be here right now.
The collapse not only cost lives, but also created traffic choke points and disrupted the region's economy. During the ceremony, Maryland's transportation secretary said that pre-construction activities have begun. The bridge is expected to reopen in the fall of 2028. For NPR News, I'm Wamboy Kamau in Baltimore.
Dollar Tree is selling its family dollar stores after a decade of trying to incorporate the bargain chain into its business. Dollar Tree acquired Family Dollar in a bidding war in 2015 for more than $8 billion. It's now selling Family Dollar to a pair of private equity firms in a deal worth $1 billion. Analysts say Dollar Tree struggled with supply chain problems, store locations that were too close to each other, and other operational weaknesses. Stocks finished lower across the board on Wall Street. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification,
whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The Supreme Court today upheld a Biden-era federal regulation that essentially bans manufacturers from selling so-called ghost guns. These are build-it-yourself gun kits, mainly bought online, that include all the parts of a gun, but they're untraceable because when assembled, they have no serial numbers. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
In 2022, as ghost guns became more and more of a problem for law enforcement, the ATF enacted a new rule classifying these kits as firearms under the 1968 Gun Control Act. That law defines a firearm as any weapon that is designed to or may readily be converted into a functional firearm. Gun manufacturers promptly challenged the new regulation, contending that a bunch of gun parts is not a gun. But today, the Supreme Court, by a 7-2 vote, upheld the regulation. Writing for the court majority, Justice Neil Gorsuch said that under the broad language of the 1968 Gun Control Act, the ATF was well within its authority in requiring those who make or sell gun kits to mark their products with serial numbers, keep records of their sales, and conduct background checks on buyers. None of these requirements was in place for unmarked guns prior to 2022, and as Gorsuch pointed out, the consequence was an explosion of ghost guns found at crime scenes across the country. Indeed, in 2017, law enforcement agencies submitted only about 1,600 ghost guns to the federal government for tracing, but by 2021, that number had jumped to 19,000.
This is an important decision that will help reduce access to guns by criminals and others who are barred from owning firearms.
UCLA law professor Adam Winkler has written extensively about guns and gun rights.
I think the best way to understand the court's decision is that there may be some gun kit out there that would not suffice to be a firearm because it required too much work for the owner to put it together. But the court seemed to suggest that those occasions would be unlikely or rare.
Indeed, in his opinion for the court today, Justice Gorsuch noted that gun kits are easy to put together in less than an hour. Pointing to the buy, build, shoot kit, he said, really, the name says it all. Dissenting from the decision were Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, who wrote separately. The lopsided majority in the gun case leaves lots of other unanswered questions, starting with how the Trump administration will react. It could, after all, seek to rescind the rule that the Supreme Court upheld today. Then, too, there are questions about where the court itself is heading. Today's case did not involve the constitutional right to bear arms, a right that the court dramatically expanded in 2022, declaring for the first time that gun laws could only be upheld if they were analogous to laws that existed at the time of the founding. But as Professor Winkler observes, there are serious and so far unanswered constitutional questions about whether the 1968 Gun Control Act at issue in today's case, whether that law satisfies the court's demand for a law analogous to one at the founding. That's just one of many conflicting signals from the court. Last year, in another gun case, the court did not require a historical analog in upholding a federal law banning domestic abusers under a court order from owning or possessing a gun. The lone dissenter was Justice Thomas, the author of the court's sweeping gun rights decision in 2022. None of these mixed signals is definitive. In fact, there are multiple challenges to state and local bans on assault weapons and large ammunition magazines that have been upheld by lower courts and are now on appeal to the Supreme Court. What is clear is this. In 2022, the Supreme Court's conservative supermajority dove headlong into the deep end of a constitutional pool that seemed to make gun control very hard to defend in court. Since then, at least so far, it has seemed a bit hesitant about heading back into the deep end. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump has announced that he is imposing a 25% tariff on all car imports. The move is intended to encourage auto manufacturers to build factories in the U.S.
This is very exciting to me. This is the automobile industry, and this will continue to spur growth like you haven't seen before. I was elected, we will lose.
But there are concerns that this will actually lead to higher prices for cars. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez joins us now from the White House to discuss. Hi, Franco.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so tell us more about what the president announced today.
Well, Trump said these tariffs will go into effect next week. They apply to both autos and auto parts. The White House says they're using national security powers to put the new tariffs in place. And they add that about half of the 16 million cars, SUVs, light trucks that Americans bought in 2024 were imports, and that even domestic-made cars rely on foreign parts. Now, Trump insists this will boost manufacturing because it'll encourage automakers to build cars and parts in the U.S. rather than import them. And he adds that the tariffs collected will boost government revenues.
I think our automobile business will flourish like it's never flourished before.
Now, the United Auto Workers Union is praising this decision, but it is also raising concern across the auto industry. Auto stocks, for example, were down today ahead of the announcement.
Okay, well, of course, these are just the latest tariffs that Trump has announced. I mean, how would you say all of this today fits into the larger picture of Trump's trade policy?
Right. Trump's already imposed a bunch of other tariffs on steel and aluminum, as well as other goods from China, Canada, and Mexico. And these latest tariffs come just a week ahead of his promised announcement of reciprocal tariffs on imports, which he says kind of punch back on countries that impose tariffs on the U.S. Today, he did say, though, that they would be more lenient than people have been fearing. He also said that today to expect tariffs on lumber and pharmaceuticals.
I mean, of course, because Trump's always talking about how he loves tariffs, right?
I'll say he really does. He calls it his favorite word. He argues that they're necessary for national security and as well as a significant stream of revenue for the country. But really, there are risks. Most economists say tariffs will raise prices for consumers, and that could hurt the economy. But Trump, you know, just also, Trump has also been on again and off again in rolling out some of these tariffs, and it's just made the markets more volatile.
Yeah. Okay. Well, all of this is happening on a day when Washington is pretty focused on a separate national security controversy. Top officials were discussing U.S. military strikes in a group chat that included a journalist. Did President Trump have anything to say about that?
He did. I mean, the White House is doubling down in its defense, arguing that critics and the media are making a bigger deal out of this than necessary. Trump called it a witch hunt and said the focus should be more on the success of the strikes on the Houthis in Yemen. But that hasn't stopped concerns. Members of Congress peppered top intelligence officials earlier today over how the journalist was added to the group chat, not to mention why they're discussing such sensitive strike details on an unsecured messaging app. Now, the White House says it is investigating to find out how the journalist was added and to make sure that it doesn't happen again. But Trump, so far, is insisting that he maintains confidence in all of those involved.
That is NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thank you, Franco.
Thank you, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. For the past month, Muslims around the world have been observing Ramadan, a time known for increased giving. But in Pakistan's largest city, the spirit of Ramadan has also fueled a unique and controversial migration trend among charity seekers. Betsy Joles has more from Karachi.
61-year-old Sayani Sumer sits on the curb in a busy commercial area in Karachi, holding a pile of medication and a paper sign asking for help. She says she's sick and needs food rations. So this afternoon, she came to the streets to ask for zakat, an obligatory form of charity in Islam for those with enough wealth, reserved for the poor and needy. It's often given out during the month of Ramadan, which started in Pakistan in early March. Sumer shows NPR an electricity bill and a medical report she says is for her high blood pressure. For these expenses, she says, she often resorts to begging. Sumer says Ramadan can be a fruitful time for it.
Many people are giving charity. We may try our luck.
Every year, people from around Pakistan flock to Karachi during Ramadan to collect charity, banking on increased generosity from people in the country's financial hub. Ramadan comes this year during a period of economic recovery in Pakistan, but many people are still struggling to get by.
It's important to understand that Pakistan's labor force, it's fairly informal and unskilled. So if you're an unskilled labor force, it's difficult to get a better price for your services.
This is economist Amar Khan. He says despite on-paper improvements, Pakistan is facing major structural challenges that limit opportunities for its working class.
We do not have any significant or serious growth happening in either modernization of agriculture or industrialization of the country.
Begging is illegal in Pakistan, though laws against it are loosely enforced. Police say there exist criminal networks that force children into the business by trafficking them. This month, the government in Karachi has arrested 220 people who they call professional beggars. In other words, those who make a living out of begging. But even though begging is socially frowned upon, many in Karachi are still willing to give money to those who ask for it, especially during Ramadan. Around sunset, dozens of people gather under a tent for iftar, the meal that breaks the day-long fast during Ramadan. Workers from a charity organization serve heaping plates of biryani from a big metal pot. 28-year-old Muhammad Yunus is among the people who've come for a free meal.
I am not a beggar, but circumstances have overwhelmed me.
He says he travels to Karachi every year during Ramadan from his hometown, around 3.5 hours away. He usually looks for daily wage work, but after failing to find any, he's resorted to staying in the streets.
I only ask people to help me.
Around 100 meters away from the iftar, people are collecting money near a well-known shrine from the Sufi tradition of Islam, which people hold in reverence because of the saint that's buried there. One Urdu word used for beggars, fakir, can also refer to religious ascetics who give up worldly possessions and exist on donations to strengthen their connection with God. Abdul Rashid, a 47-year-old who traveled nearly 8 hours to Karachi for Ramadan, says he's here to bring the saint his troubles.
Because they are saints, and saints are the friends of Allah. Everyone comes to them in the name of Allah.
He says he hopes God will grant him what he needs. And for that, help might come from the people of Karachi. With Samir Mundro, for NPR News, I'm Betsy Joles in Karachi, Pakistan.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Secretary of Defense and top intelligence officials in the Trump administration discussed ongoing military operations in Yemen on the widely available app Signal. The chat was made public because the editor of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, was added accidentally to the group thread. But this news lands a little bit differently with veterans and active duty troops. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
Two members of the president's cabinet who were on that Signal chat came back to Capitol Hill today for scheduled hearings, CIA Director John Ratcliffe and Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard. Here she is getting grilled about the Signal chat by Pennsylvania Democrat Chrissy Houlihan.
You're a former battalion commander in the Army. Would this seem to qualify to you as something worthy of that investigation?
Thank you for your question, Congresswoman. In this situation, Secretary Hegseth has the classification and declassification.
Houlihan is a former Air Force officer, and Gabbard is a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve. As such, they likely both know what happens when active duty personnel compromise sensitive information, which is called spillage.
What typically happens in a spillage as serious as this is they're immediately fired. They're processed for being kicked out of the military. And they're referred for criminal prosecution.
Kevin Carroll served 30 years in the Army and in the CIA and at Homeland Security in the first Trump administration. As a lawyer, he's defended troops who accidentally leaked information, though nothing anywhere near spilling a planned airstrike in Yemen in advance to a reporter in an unsecured chat group.
I've defended spillage cases where people were going to be put out of the military or people were going to be turned out of their job within the military. For violations that are just the smallest fraction of what just occurred.
Military officers who've sent even old battlefield assessments, he says, have immediately lost their jobs. And he says that watching leadership spill potentially deadly information and so far suffer no consequences is demoralizing for troops. But that gap is sadly common enough that there's a phrase for it in the military. Different spanks for different ranks.
You use the phrase I was going to use, different spanks for different ranks. It's terrible for morale because the GIs know that they would absolutely be crucified for this kind of activity and that nothing is going to happen to the Secretary of Defense.
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth said again today that he did nothing wrong. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
Over the last decade, new online platforms have made it easier than ever to go from anonymity to online fame and fortune. But that viral success can also come at a cost. From our Planet Money podcast, Alexi Horowitz-Ghazi and Nick Nevis bring us a parable of the modern attention economy.
Mark Longo was working as a building inspector in Manhattan back in 2017 when he came across an orphaned baby squirrel in the middle of the street. Mark is an animal lover, so he brought the squirrel home to nurse it back to health, and he named him Peanut.
Over the next year, Mark started posting videos of him and Peanut on social media, wearing little cowboy hats and sports jerseys, and the internet and the press soon fell in love.
We went on British TV, and they deemed him the world's most famous squirrel, and that's when his TikTok blew up, and that's where, 100,000 followers became a few million.
All that attention started to bring strange new opportunities. Mark and Peanut started making sponsored content for nut companies. The celebrity shout-out website Cameo invited them onto the platform.
I fist-pumped that squirrel so many damn times because he just nailed these interviews like it was something that he was meant to do.
Peanut knew how to turn on the charm.
Did he ever? Especially with ladies. Like, he was a ladies' man.
And at some point, it became clear that some of Peanut's followers were also interested in Mark.
I met my wife because of Peanut.
No way. Mark is kind of ripped. He wears these tight-fitting outfits in his Peanut videos, and a lot of their followers were posting raunchy comments about Mark. And before long, he says, he got a message from a manager representing OnlyFans creators.
OnlyFans is a video streaming platform where creators make customized content for paying subscribers. Mostly, it's homemade adult content, which was what this manager was suggesting Mark start to make.
They were like, listen, you come off as a very innocent man with an animal. Could you imagine if we were to kind of shift from A to Z, put you on OnlyFans, what you can make?
Peanut himself would never appear in any adult videos. All Mark had to do was convert some Peanut fans into paying subscribers on OnlyFans.
So I kind of just sat down and was like, you know what? Let's give this a shot. If it gets shot down or it doesn't work, I'm naked on the internet. And literally, we launched it at like 10 o'clock in the morning, and within the first 20 minutes, I had a couple thousand subscribers.
Pretty soon, Mark says, he and his wife were bringing in more than $10,000 a month through OnlyFans. They were doing so well, they decided to open up a nonprofit animal sanctuary in Peanut's name. They bought a farm, started acquiring rescue horses and donkeys and alpacas, eventually totaling over 300 animals. And for a while, everything was going well.
Until the morning of October 30th, 2024. That's when a convoy of SUVs from the New York Department of Environmental Conservation arrived at the farm with a warrant for Peanut. Because, as the officers reminded Mark, he had failed to get a permit to keep wildlife as a pet.
Over the next several hours, New York State officers made Mark and his wife stand by as they scoured the property. Until, finally...
I was midway on the staircase. I had three cops to my right. I had three to my left. And one of them yelled, "I found Peanut. I found the squirrel."
The officers took Peanut into custody. And after three harrowing days...
I get a phone call from our local news station from a gentleman who's in tears. And he's like, "Mark, I don't know how to tell you, but they're gone."
According to a statement from the New York Department of Environmental Conservation, Peanut had bitten someone involved with the investigation. And as part of a protocol to test whether he had rabies, Peanut had been euthanized.
Mark was devastated, and he took to social media to tell the world what had happened. And pretty soon, the story went absolutely viral. It was all over the news.
You're hearing Elon Musk talk about it, and you're hearing J.D. Vance, and now Donald Trump Jr.
"Our government will let in 600,000 criminals across our border, but if someone has a pet squirrel without a permit, they go in there and kill the squirrel."
And then...
How did you first find out that Peanut had been turned into some form of cryptocurrency?
I'm sitting in the gym working out. I get a phone call from my lawyer.
It turned out some anonymous party had turned Peanut into a meme coin, a kind of joke cryptocurrency. And in the media frenzy surrounding Peanut's death, the coin's estimated value had swelled to over $2 billion.
And I'm like, "You kidding me? Like, it's, you know, we're not talking about like you made $1,000. Like, you made $100 million off of this story, and you didn't include me and my family?"
Mark tried convincing the Peanut meme coin creators to cut him in on the profits. He also tried launching competing meme coins, but they collapsed in a swirl of accusations and infighting. Now he's threatening legal action against various coin creators and crypto platforms.
Mark is trying to keep Peanut's story alive however he can. But he's learned how fickle and impermanent the world's attention can be. For the moment, he says he and his family are surviving on donations and revenue from OnlyFans. Alexi Horowitz-Ghazi.
Nick Navis.
NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young. We'll be right back.